This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Even amongst the greatest of all Bob Dylan songs, the Tangled Up in Blues, the It's All Right Ma, the I'm Not There, and whatever else you might put on that list, Blind Willie McTell stands apart. It feels big, important, and mysterious. Listening to it is a pleasure and a challenge because it feels like you just can't get your head around it. There are lots of Dylan songs that confuse or confound, but this one pulls you to try, intellectually, emotionally, maybe even spiritually. Although full grasp seems always a little more than out of reach. The fact that Dylan had this locked up in a pile of unreleased tapes for almost a decade is one of those facts that also taunts us. How could that be? I think that if you want to understand Bob Dylan and fully appreciate him, and to the degree it's possible to even get near understanding him, you have to try and see things once in a while from his point of view. I'm not saying that's easy or even possible, and sometimes he intentionally lies, but other times I think he tells us the truth. In 2006, Dylan talked about Blind Willie McTell, and he was asked why it was left behind. Most likely it was a demo, he said, probably showing the musicians how it should go. It was never fully developed. I never got around to completing it. There wouldn't have been any other reason for leaving it off the record. It's like taking a painting by Monet or Picasso, going to his house and looking at half-finished paintings, grabbing it and selling it to people who are, quote-unquote, Picasso fans. So you're Bob Dylan. You write hundreds of songs, sometimes dozens and dozens in a year. You record hundreds of them and thousands of takes. Plus, of course, do over 3,000 shows on the road. You know what you have in mind, what you're capable of, and you don't always have the time or the patience to reach it. Sometimes it's not working and you just move on. The fact that Dylan left this one behind for a while is part of the story. But the fact that he brought it back, he ultimately released 3 different takes of it. He played it live 226 times, tells us that he came around. He realized the mistake, he appreciated the song, and he shared it forcefully with the world. Of course, we're not Bob Dylan. So when this thing dropped in 1993, if you were there, you know it was a sonic boom even among all the amazing discoveries in the first bootleg series box. Yes, of course, a bootleg recording had circulated for years, although that's a relatively small number of us who had heard that. It's now been over 30 years since the official release, yet the power and the mystery remain. The song is one of those that's just as impactful when you hear it now as it was the first time you heard it. And even for the many of us that have listened hundreds or thousands of times, the mystery largely remains. In Song and Dance Man Volume 2, Michael Gray dives deep into Blind Willie McTell, the song and the man. And today, we're talking to him all about it. As always, what you're about to hear is maybe 1% of what the book chapter reveals, although check our blog and Substack and there's going to be an excerpt from this great chapter. But as always, I really recommend you grab the book at Amazon, there's a link in the show notes, to learn all about it. This is just an amazing chapter. Also in the show notes are links to a new playlist called Blind Willie McTell, The Song and the Man, featuring the Dylan versions, great covers, and many of the Blind Willie McTell songs that Michael mentions in this episode. But enough of all of this. Let's talk to Michael Gray about Blind Willie McTell.
Seen the arrow on a dark wall, saying this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem.
Blind Willie McTell is no roaring primitive and no Robert Johnson-esque devil-dealing womanizer. He didn't lose his sight in a juke joint brawl or hopping a freight train. He didn't escape into music from behind a mule plow in the Delta. He didn't die violently or young. Instead, blind from youth, but never behaving as if it were a handicap, this intelligent, articulate man became an adept professional singer and 12-string guitar player who traveled widely and talked his way into an array of recording sessions. He never achieved a hit record, but he became, as a live performer and a man, one of the most widely known and well-loved figures in and around Georgia, working clubs and car parks, playing to blacks and whites, tobacco workers and college kids, Blind Willie McTell, Human Jukebox, and Local Hero, enjoyed a modest career and an independent life.
All right, Michael, welcome back. We're at another peak here, following the great Joker Man with something that most of our listeners know you as a Bob Dylan author, and you've written much else, but one of those is a huge work on Blind Willie McTell. So we're deep in your sweet spot today. You know, he's almost a metaphor in the song, right? Most people don't come to the song knowing him at all or very much, and it almost doesn't matter because Dylan's creates
absolutely
him.
Absolutely. That's how I came to it. I mean, I heard the Dylan song bootlegged long before it was officially released. And when I heard it, I naturally wondered, well, how does Blind Willie McTell sing the blues, or indeed sing anything else? And I was rather stereotypically expecting a kind of Howling Wolf type figure, you know? And actually, when I heard him, he sounded, he had more of a sweet tone like Roy Orbison than Howling Wolf. So that was the first thing. And I was so intrigued that I just wanted to research him. I mean, I wanted to find out what was known about him as a man and his life and his times. And what I found was a shockingly small amount of stuff that had ever been published, which is why I got into the business of writing the book. The book is not only his story, but the story of getting his story. And that's because it was so difficult to get. I couldn't just go to somebody else's book or an encyclopedia of the blues or any of that sort of thing. All I could do was find out where he was born as best I could and take it from there. But luckily, he was not only untypical of a blues singer in having such a sweet voice, but he was also untypical of any musician, really, in being extremely precise about detail. What I found, luckily, was a recording that had been made by John Lomax and his wife in an Atlanta hotel in 1940. They had recorded Willie for the Library of Congress. They paid him $1 in his taxi fare. But on that recording, Willie says, "I was born in Happy Valley, 9.5 miles from Thompson, Georgia." So that gave me a starting point. I went to Georgia, and that's where I found a great deal of his time had been spent. And when I, in the rental car, when I drove back from Happy Valley into downtown Thompson, as you cross the rail track into downtown Thompson, the mileage on the car, 9.5 miles, it was just ridiculous how accurate he was about things. You know, he, unlike Bob Dylan, he never created myths about himself. Absolutely not at all. So that was one thing. He seemed to have been blind from birth and yet uncannily good at moving around the world and being independent. And when he moved to Atlanta in 1927, when he made his first record, you know, he got an apartment. He got a telephone so that he could get booked into professional gigs and so on. A really remarkable independent guy. And his recordings, well, there's a lot of it, and some of it's not so good. But the early blues stuff he did for Victor Records is scintillating. The only thing I'd like to add is that he came back to Thompson, a small town in Georgia. He came back to Thompson after he'd had a couple of strokes. And after the second one, his speech was impaired and he didn't make much sense to people. And therefore, they took him to the hospital. But the local hospital in Thompson would not admit him because he was black. So his cousin took him to Milledgeville, which was this enormous state mental asylum hospital in the old colonial capital of Georgia, Milledgeville. And he died there in August 1959. And I managed eventually to get the medical notes for his time there. I mean, he wasn't mentally ill at all. But the thing was, it was just ironic that whereas there's no birth certificate for him, and there's only one marriage certificate, and that's full of lies, the last 2 weeks of his life in the hospital, he's documented every 4 hours of his life. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So that's how he ended up. But his story is remarkable. He was an amazing guy.
Is that Lomax video circulate, or the audio recording?
Audio. Yes, it's incomplete though. It was presented as complete, but actually it's not. They snipped some bits off so that the Library of Congress could send it to Larry Cohn, this guy who used to work for Columbia Records. Well, when I finally got the extra bits, it quite changed the whole mood of the atmosphere in the room between John Lomax, who was this fierce white Texan in his 70s, grilling William McTell in a segregated hotel room in 1940. When you get the full recording, it sounds far more sympathetic than on the clipped version. I think all McTell's stuff is available online really now.
So the book spends 10 or 15 pages on McTell, both not so much biography as you do in your other book, but the songs and the influences that perk up in Dylan. So you kind of, the chapter goes from McTell to Dylan, and the second two-thirds is Dylan back to McTell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it isn't until 1993 that Dylan records a McTell song, Broke Down Engine Blues, which is on World Gone Wrong. But before that, even in the Born Again phase, he brings a little phrase of McTell's into one of the songs. He sings about this woman, his woman, who she can really do the Georgia crawl. That phrase, she can really do the Georgia crawl, straight out of a McTell song, a secular song, of course. And even Lay Across My Big Brass Bed is from a Ruth Willis pre-war blues track, which has McTell singing in the background and playing the guitar. And it's called Rough Alley Blues. So it's, he really knew that stuff early on, and he plucks it out and uses it in many of the songs of his own, yeah.
Let's listen to another excerpt from Song and Dance Man, Volume 2.
As the British blues expert Simon Napier wrote in sleeve notes to an album of McTell's later work, quote, he sounds like no other artist, nor does he apparently subscribe to the trend set by other artists, unquote. And, quote, he has the compelling, dramatic voice of the best bluesmen, coupled with the wit and imagery of the greatest folk poet, unquote. All of which sounds sort of familiar. Blind Willie McTell, like Bob Dylan, is a complex, intelligent, articulate personality and artist. And behind Dylan's great song reverberates a thorough knowledge of McTell's exquisite work. And, I think, Dylan's sense of a deep companionship of spirit between them. McTell's life is the stuff of exactly the sort of troubadour romance Bob Dylan fantasized for himself in his early years and has carried in his heart ever since. McTell is the blues singer Dylan would have been if he'd been born in time.
You point out that relative to the song, there are a lot of reasons he chose Blind Willie McTell to be the namesake of the song, perhaps not least of which is it's a better rhyme than some of his contemporaries.
Yeah, it would be very hard to rhyme. No one can sing the blues like Robert Johnson. That would be hard. Yeah, and so McTell works well. But of course, it's also, he likes the pun of Tell on in McTell, you know. It's part of saying how eloquent McTell is. That telling is in his very name, if you like. Not that Willie ever pronounced it that way. His family pronounced it McTeer. His real name was McTeer, which is, there are 37 different spellings of that in the Georgia area, white and black McTeers. But the usual one is MC and then TIER. But the way that they say it, McTeel, is exactly like McTell, you know. So that's how he becomes McTell. So Dylan's, one of the main things about Dylan's song, Blind Willie McTell, is about McTell's articulacy, isn't it? No one can sing the blues like this. And of course, in terms of technically of the voice, no one does. No one else sounds like Blind Willie McTell. But, you know, it goes deeper than that, doesn't it? I mean, he's talking about McTell's ability to create a requiem, if you like, to pay tribute to what's lost, to what's gone.
Yeah, I find that phrase, it's a little bit like we spoke of last time with Joker Man, that it's a it's a phrase that's spit out repeatedly through the song that means worlds. And the literacy of this line, no one sings the blues like Blind Willie McTell. Like you say, the first thing you do is, oh, I got to hear this guy. And you do think magic is going to come out of the speaker. And as you say, it's beautiful, but it's different. It's clear that's not the singular point.
Right.
And I also think there's a similarity in the songs that, and I'd love to hear what you think about this, that the verses are related to McTell, but they're also, as you point out through this chapter, worlds bigger. And he's just the chorus, or it's not even a chorus, it's just a repeated line throughout the song, is serving this other purpose of refocusing and representing everything that couldn't be said.
And it's refocusing on the loss, using the blues as you know, a form of lamentation, where it is a lamentation, and he's paying tribute to McTell's ability to sing a lamentation. But as you say, Dylan is bringing in a huge range of things into this song, you know, the arrow on the doorpost, many martyrs falling in East Texas. There's just loads of stuff in this. These are all things which are lamentable, if you like.
So before we start in on some of those verses and some of the allusions and references, let's talk, as we have before, about the overall, because I think, you know, the songs that you've chosen to focus on full chapters that we've talked about a bunch, there is a pattern here that these are songs that are just, you know, this is a song that I think you don't have to dive deeply into to feel like it's special, meaning it just sounds interesting and compelling. It's highly differentiated, even in the vastness of Dylan's catalog. Yes. It feels important before you know anything else about it. It really is a special song before introspection.
Absolutely, it is. And I think I say in the book that it's the most important spooky song since Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel. And that's something to do with the sound quality, isn't it? As well as the mysteriousness of the narrative. As you say, you can hear it without at all worrying about what it means. And it does strike you immediately as a special thing.
So the transition in the book between the McTell biography and history and the various connections between him and Dylan and the meat of the song is the evolution, if you will, from what you call the rake cycle history to St. Jane's Infirmary into this song. So maybe you can share a condensed version of, this is a literal connection between Blind Willie and the song beyond his name being in it.
There's a cycle of songs called The Unfortunate Rake. And this starts out as an English folk song. It's very old, but it isn't first recorded or even written down by any researcher until far later. But it's an English folk song, and it's found in Ireland and England, and it crosses to America. And in America, what happens is that it branches out into white and black versions. And the white versions include The Streets of Laredo and The Bad Girl's Lament. And the black versions include St. James Infirmary Blues and a song by Blind Willie McTell called The Dying Crapshooter's Blues. Although they, on the face of it, don't sound all that much as if they're the same sort of song, they all have this set of core ingredients. And Dylan seems to understand that this is the case, whichever of them he has been listening to, and he probably listened to all of them. First of all, they share the centrality of burial. The song is always a story, and it's a story in which someone is dying, or in the case of the Dylan song, everything is dying. Dying is central to each song, and then the structure of all of them is based on there being two narrators, not just one. You get the first narrator who is telling the story, and what he or she sings is that he was walking wherever in Laredo or somewhere in Ireland, wherever you're walking. This first narrator is walking along and meets a tragic dying figure and tells their story. Tells their story in the dying figure's words so that we hear the voice of the second person. And then there are various other ingredients that are common to each, like flowers. There's always flowers involved. And also there's always a listing by the dying person of what is required for the funeral or for commemorating the death, or if you like, for the requiem, for the lamentation, for the death, for the singing of the blues at the funeral. And so those things are all common to all of these songs, however differently the dialect or turns of phrase of these different versions may include. It took me years before I kind of really clocked this, but once I had, I was pleased to see that you could trace it. You could certainly trace all those elements into the Dying Crapshooter's Blues, the song by Blind Willie McTell, which was one of the last things he recorded in 1956. In a record shop on somebody's home computer in the back of a record shop in Atlanta. And it has this long and brilliant spoken introduction, which is really one of the best things he ever did. There's a lot of specifying by the dead person he meets in that song about what he wants. He wants all the women from the something or other hotel, and he wants this and he wants that. He wants this many horses going to the graveyard, and so on and so on. And Dylan just avoids these things becoming a list, but he throws in the same elements. So we have the flowers, we have the sweet magnolia bloom, and so on. Every element is there, You just have to be on the lookout for it. And of course, towards the end of the song, Dylan gets quite specific because he's gazing out the window of the St. James Hotel. So, you know, he's naming half of the song St. James Infirmary Blues. In the case of the Dylan song, the first narrator is just an owl. And the second narrator is saying he hears the owl, just like in the other songs, someone hears the dying person. I heard that hoot owl singing as they were taking down the tents. The stars above the barren trees was his only audience. But it wasn't, was it? Because it was also heard by the person who sings the rest of the song, who starts with, I heard that hoot owl singing. Yeah.
It's another one of those songs that, there's no particularly oblique language, and yet it feels like things are missing. You know, it's both sure. complete, and it paints a picture, and the amount of vagary is kind of astounding.
Yes, and things are disconnected in the way that they're presented. I mean, what is the connection between the man with the bootleg whiskey in his hand and anything else in the song? The taking down the tents or whatever else it might be, the slavery ships. And yet they do connect, don't they? I mean, there's a vivid history of the turmoil, the turbulent history of the United States in there. And the tents, for example, taking down the tents, this is when people are having to move on, isn't it? This is when people are refugees they're flooding away from East Texas, or in the case of the people from the Old Testament who are referred to with the arrow on the doorpost, you know, he's referring there to bits of Deuteronomy and Exodus, and the Exodus involves people moving. You know, they're having to flee. It's an Exodus. They're fleeing out of Egypt. And at another point in the song, people are falling in East Texas. I mean, they're being martyred too. And the arrow on the doorpost, you have to, in the biblical story, you have to mark your doorpost with blood so that the angel, the avenging angel, only kills Egyptians and not the Jews. And the arrow, as opposed to the blood, is more like from the Deuteronomy story, in which people just put a sign on their door to prove that they're God-fearing, righteous folk. So presumably, again, there's some need for them to mark themselves out in that way.
It occurs to me, as you say that one of the tricks or techniques that Dylan's using here is he's jumping through time, almost the same way as the, you know, Tangled Up in Blue plays with pronouns.
Yes,
you know, it sounds like it's about the 20s and 30s and 40s and the Blind Willie McTell time period, and the name kind of suggests that in certain parts of it. But as you say, yeah, we jet around pretty freely.
We certainly do. And another way in which he jumps around is, you know, when he comes to that God's in his heaven bit, because what's being referenced there is a well-known poem by 19th century British poet Robert Browning. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world is part of that poem. And in that poem, Browning rolls backwards in the book. I described the different steps in which it happens. But, you know, we start with spring and we end up with the morning and so on. We slide backwards. And in the same way, quite a lot of this Dylan song is sliding backwards through American history. But as I think one of the excerpts in this podcast is going to say, there's a lot more to it than than merely rolling backwards. But certainly, you know, the whole stuff about the slavery ships, there's a lot of identification with the past history of people like Blind Willie McTell in this song.
Let's listen to another excerpt from Song and Dance Man, Volume 2.
Falsity, vanity, and corruption compound cruelty and pain. Everywhere people are fallen, in chains, under the whip, in this maelstrom of history. I say maelstrom because, though it's been said that Blind Willie McTell rolls backwards through America's past, in truth the song offers no such consistent reverse chronology, and its vision is not limited to American terrain, though it returns to it time and again, not least by the device of Blind Willie McTell's omnipresence. This may disappoint the need for neatness, but it is a strength of the song that most of its images evoke more than one era, more than one time and place, while pressing upon us time and again a running analogy between Old Testament and New World.
The book does a wonderful job of as close as you come throughout the volumes, I think, to covering every verse, because there's so much there, and they're compact, even though there's a fair number of them. Let's just talk about a few of the lines that ring out for a minute.
Okay.
So why don't I just call out a few, and you can tell us if there's a reference here or it was just a phrase that rhymed with something well. Many martyrs fell. Is that specific martyrs we're talking about, or?
I can't see that it can be. There's absolutely no clue as to which martyrs he's talking about. It's a lovely line, but it's poetry, you know. He may have some specific thing in mind, but he's not explaining it.
You talk a bit about those charcoal gypsy maidens strutting their feathers well.
Yeah, isn't that a great line? I mean, that's just, and quite a brave line, because, you know, the excessively woke police could be on him for that. It's charcoal maidens strutting their feathers well. I mean, but you know, what does it evoke, apart from the loveliness of the line itself, of the sheer beauty of the phrasing? What it evokes is a particular kind of medicine showbiz, isn't it? It's part of that history of the ways in which Black Americans had to get by.
And it's interesting that rather pleasant evocation immediately precedes the plantations burning, cracking whips, and slavery ships. So we have a hard left turn juxtaposition there.
Yeah, well, he goes, you know, those who survived the slavery ships and land in America, or of course in the West Indies, those who land in America, their slavery continues a very long time. And one of the ways out of slavery and the extremely racist regime that follows it, in which Blind Willie McTell lived his entire life, one of the ways out of that for a resourceful Black person was, if you like, the entertainment industry in the 19th century and the 20th. And in the 19th century, medicine shows and carnivals and, you know, all the rest of it. All that was a way of not having to stand behind a mule in the Delta plowing all day. It's one of the ways in which McTell personified that resourcefulness. You know, he was lucky; he had a great talent, but he parlayed it with inspiring resourcefulness.
Then you point out that the next verse is about the tribes a-moaning, which you point out again, we leave the continent and go somewhere else, perhaps, in the illusion.
Well, and also, of course, as Dylan has done in other songs, he makes a parallel, doesn't he, between the tribes of Israel, the tribes of in the Old Testament, and the tribes of Black Americans, the tribes of Africans brought somewhere else. I mean, he does it in on the Christian albums, on the Born Again albums, doesn't he? He parallels these two great stories.
There's a lot of these that you could imagine. It's like Hard Rain, right? Where not every line is a different song, but every stanza could be a different song. But this one is a little bit perhaps the most out of place, depending on how you think about it. It adds the right spice to the song. But a woman by the river with the fine young handsome man dressed up by like a squire, bootleg whiskey in his hand.
Yeah.
So many questions.
Yes, so many questions. The squire is, of course, you know, you can't help feeling that this is the landed gentry, the American landed gentry, and yet the bootleg whiskey is what the local blacks have been producing, at the same time, it's like Jesus and the woman in the well. Can I just go back to the paralleling of the tribes and say that, you know, specifically in one of those Born Again songs, he says, you know, both our forefathers were slaves, where he's specifically addressing the black woman.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty specific. I can't actually remember whether that's in Covenant Woman or Precious Angel, but it's in one of the two.
So we also have the fine young handsome man with bootleg whiskey in his hand also is another one of these cases where Bob references something he's going to do 30 years later. Of course, it was his first heaven. It was his first Heaven's Door advertisement.
That's very nice. Yeah.
Like the ladies' underwear and the Victoria's Secret.
Yeah.
And many others.
Some of these bootleggers make pretty good stuff.
Well, of all the admissions I'd love to have him make is that one was about the guys with wires running down their shirts.
McTell's family made bootleg whiskey.
Oh, all right. That's an interesting fact.
And of course, it's a central theme of one of the most beautiful songs on Self-Portrait, which is Copper Kettle.
Sounds like there's a bootleg.
We ain't paid no whiskey tax since 1792.
Let's listen to another excerpt from Song and Dance Man, Volume 2.
One of Dylan's inspired touches here in that nigh-perfect penultimate stanza is to underscore his tolling of doomsday by alluding to and then contorting these well-known lines of optimism and hope. God is in his heaven, all's right with the world. The twisting of this fresh-faced couplet into the brutish modernism of, well, God is in his heaven and we all want what's his, could hardly be bettered. Dylan uses the mugging energy of the bare greed he describes to give his lines a slashing economy, hitting us with the switch from the lost innocence of the original.
As always, I'm pleased in reading to have you, to see you stop and pull back from the specific and realize, as you always do, that it's Dylan's singing and the expressiveness and the conviction that comes from him that really delivers this song. You know, we talked a minute ago about how you don't really need to listen to know it's important, but when you do really listen, you're paid off handsomely. It's incredible.
And one of the ways his famous refusal to sing the same line the same way twice. There's a very subtle example of this, not just in the way he sings it, but in the way the song is constructed, in the way that it ends, which is that, you know, the chorus line is always, "No one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell." And on the electric version, you know, he ends it singing, "Blind Willie McTell," in a very demure way. Whereas people doing cover versions, any ordinary singer has to signify that this is going to be the end of the song. So they go, "McTell," you know? And Dylan would never do that. It's the same on Positively 4th Street, where there's absolutely no ba-bang at the end. It's just a quiet ba-bang. But then in the actual construction of the song too, there's a difference at the end. It's a subtle signaling, if you will, that it is the end. And that is, every other rhyme to McTell in the song is a straight one-syllable sound. Yell, bell, fell. But the last one is it's just different. It's a two-syllable word, and it's hotel. That's the last rhyming word. And it's the only one that is a two-syllable word at the end. And I love that. I can't say why particularly. I just love it.
So it's tell and tell only the last time.
I was also trying to remember whether hotel is a feminine rhyme or because the emphasis was on the second syllable of the word, unlike, you know, rubbish, where the emphasis is on the first syllable. And Dylan, perfectly capable of choosing which syllable to put the emphasis on in any word. But you know, he follows what you might say is the norm there with hotel.
So you briefly talked before about the two versions. I have the 7-inch of the bootleg outtakes that was put out by it's a Third Man, by Third Man. Never actually spun this, but I have it.
That that photo only exists because someone alertly spotted it on top of a pile that was put out for the junk man outside the offices of a magazine in New York City. A man called John Reynolds spotted it and rescued it. And it is the only photography studio photograph of Blind Willie McTell. It was taken for Victor Records in 1927. And my biography of Willie describes that photograph in great detail, including the telltale things that show that it was a black photographer's studio. The tattiness of the secondhand background and so on.
And it's a 12-string acoustic.
Oh, yeah. That's his instrument.
It's a beautiful photo.
He played the 12-string acoustic because it gives a bigger noise than a 6-string. And because in a lot of the towns that he was playing in the 20s and early 30s, there was no electricity. You couldn't decide to go electric like Bob. That's how it was.
This may be an unfair question, but in the massiveness of Dylan's canon, where and how does this song sit? We have a number of special songs, but this is clearly one of them.
Well, it's difficult to divide things into songs sometimes because, you know, if you pull apart something like Bringing It All Back Home, the album is greater than the sum of the parts. But yes, there are some songs that stand out individually out of all other considerations. And this would be in my top 10. Even though it comes, you know, from the era where he was supposedly at his least creative and productive.
Well, let's end with our final excerpt from Song and Dance Man, Volume 2, available at Amazon.com on Kindle and in paperback. Here's Michael Gray on Blind Willie McTell.
The work of art, as ever with Bob Dylan, is the recording, not the words on the page. But the words on the page demand from Dylan and receive two of his most focused performances. Paying tribute to McTell's artistry, he rises to the occasion with the excellence of his own. What a song, you say, when you read the lyric. What a record, you say, when you hear the belatedly issued performance.
Thanks for listening.